Putting the K in Debate is proud to present Critical Issues in Debate, its new podcast series. A conversation about debate.
For people in both
high school and college.
Competitors.
Students, teachers, coaches, thinkers.
This is Callum Matheson, and you're listening to Critical Issues in Debate.
Thank you for joining us. We appreciate you listening to our first ever podcast. My name is Scott Oderkirk, and I'll be attempting to host this thing. We are very fortunate today to have with us one of the most respected members of the debate community at both the high school and the college level. As a debater, he received 3 first-round bids. He was twice in the semifinals of the National Debate Tournament. He once lost in the finals of CETA Nationals, where he was the top speaker. He's also coached the top speaker of a national debate tournament. His teams have also reached the finals of the Tournament of Champions that he's coached at Glenbrook South. He's currently also an assistant coach at Harvard. He's well accomplished. He's also one of our best staff members of our national debate camps across the country. We are very fortunate to have with us Callum Matheson today, and I just want to say thanks for joining us, man.
Thanks a lot, Scott. I really appreciate your invitation to do this.
Well, we'll see how it goes. Maybe it'll just suck real bad, and we'll both look like fools.
Well, right now, I appreciate it.
Okay, so, you know, there's a lot, you know, really the reason why you're on the podcast is when I was a sophomore, that was the year where you were in finals of CETA, and that debate that you had in that final round was, like, huge for my intellectual development. I want to talk about that eventually, and how you did as a debater was really cool and stuff, but I know kind of absolutely nothing about your origin and sort of how you started in debate. I mean, from my perspective, you were always kind of this phenom guy. But I kind of want to know, like, how did you get into debate and what hooked you at the beginning?
Well, debate in high school, this is actually a little bit embarrassing for me to think about this now, but, I started debate my sophomore year in high school, and my freshman year I had taken the debate class, but I took it because my high school had 2 lunch periods, and fourth period debate overlapped with one of them, and I thought that I could probably skip it and just go home for a couple of hours in the middle of the day. So I took debate, and I got 100% on the midterm, so they asked me to come to a tournament. I didn't debate, but I went to the Northwestern High School tournament. And basically, my friend Steve and I just wandered around Evanston, and we watched a couple of debates, but we mostly just did whatever we wanted to. And I got out of school, and I hated school. So I decided to debate the next year, so I didn't have to go to school as much. And the first tournament I went to, as a novice, I was the top speaker, and my parents were really happy, and I thought that I'd stick with it. I didn't really expect to be successful. I just kind of wanted to not have to do things. but after a couple of tournaments, I decided I liked it.
Well,
stuck around it.
It's kind of weird that you bring up that you hated school, because it seems like for me there's kind of 2 kinds of debaters. There's the ones that are sort of the amazing Uber students that we're all trying to coach and mentor and bring up on our teams, and then unfortunately, there's the ones of us that escape from some of our academic duties in debate. Has that?
Yeah, I certainly did that.
Yeah, I mean, has there been times where being your debate career has traded off worse than just sort of disliking school in that one weekend with your buddy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the amount of time that I put into debate in college made it difficult to be as successful academically as I wanted. And the same is true in high school. When I was in high school, my senior year, I think my absence rate was something like 20% over the course of the year. It was, you know, nearly impossible. But in fairness, I never did really badly in school. I didn't like it very much in high school, but I was an okay student, not a great one, but not a bad one. In reality, probably I could have been a good student if I had wanted to. It wasn't the debate took up too much time. It's the debate plus everything else I was doing, which,
yeah.
Which is very little. It was productive. That took up a lot of time.
Yeah, I think but, for me, there was even like a minimum where, I mean, sometimes the debate team sort of saved me, where at least I made a minimum grade point, or like at least I did like a minimum amount of stuff to be eligible sometimes. So there are, I think it kind of goes both ways. And there's certainly a bunch of those kids out there that just become these super students. I think actually the Einstein type that hates school is sort of the exception to the rule. But
I think that's one thing that's great about debate, though. I think it attracts people who are not lazy and are not anti-intellectual. They just don't like the intellectual environment that they're in. And there's, in a lot of ways, you know, you can criticize debate for the amount of time that it takes and the sort of bizarre parody of specific education that it imparts. But I think that that function alone would make it worthwhile, that it sort of gives people a place where they can pursue intellectual interests outside of the kind of an annoying structure that most of us are forced into when we're in high school.
I mean, is that what's kept you in it so long, or is it something else, or what?
That's a lot of it, yeah. I mean, in some sense, I'm still in debate because I, like, really am not all that good at anything else. I don't have another skill that
I feel.
I could rely on to support myself, but that's not really the primary reason. The primary reason is that I enjoy the intellectual exercise of it. In particular, the way that it teaches you to analyze and make decisions, I think, is important. And I'm still around because I think judging is, in some ways, accomplishes that better than actually debating does. But I also like the idea that debate allows you to discuss ideas in conflict with each other that would never really occur outside of this, and to analyze them in their own merits to the degree that that's possible, and that I really enjoy.
Well, I mean, just for fact's sake, you have been quoted in some actual, like, debate documentaries saying some pretty outlandish things about why you love debate in terms of impact turning and all that kind of stuff. Have you been in context in those quotes, or, you know, it's fine with me if you are. I'm just wondering, you know, some of those are kind of flaming.
I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I do actually think that impact turns and that style of debate is fascinating to me because it, not because of the content of the arguments themselves, it's the way that one can pursue extremity and argument without having an ideological attachment to what you're saying. And I think that that's valuable, that debate in some ways forces you to at least explore fundamental assumptions that one has about the world, even if you don't believe what you're saying, and even if, you know, you don't change anything that you believe as a result of it. I think that it's worthwhile to sort of explore the roots of belief, and impact turns accomplish that. I also thought that part of the game that was fun is advancing arguments that I knew to be false.
That's awesome.
There's something about that that I think is good. It would be irresponsible of me to do that now, you know, in graduate school and so on, or when I would, you know, eventually move on to a professional academic career. So it's, you know, my strength was not the pursuit of truth. My strength was more the sort of...
All right, well, then... Let's talk about your strength, because I just walked out of a 3-hour film session with a couple of my debaters on your 2002 CETA final round, and man, that was really a really good debate. You know, I want to get into a breakdown a little bit more, but just in terms of your strength, kind of saying no,
That's good. I like the way you phrased it.
Saying no so well. It was like that 2NC was like one of the most prolific speeches. It was like filled with all of these rhetorical kind of twists and turns. It was largely, you know, kind of saying no to the extreme almost, just like saying no in a bunch of really rhetorically powerful ways. Is that your strength? Is it like voraciously disagreeing in a way that's persuasive to people, or is there something, I mean, because that's what it seems like on the surface. Is that what it is?
Maybe. It's difficult to answer a question like that. It's hard to be objective about the function of one's own mind.
Yeah, are you a good enough judge to judge yourself?
Maybe. I mean, it's also difficult to say it's a strength, because actually doing it was totally different. You know, the strategy that we, in the end, pursued in that debate, we were nearly totally unprepared for.
Yeah, that was, I was like, where's the, he's not really proving much here, but man, he is persuasive about it.
Well, most of what was in the 2NC, I sort of figured out in the middle of the 1AC that that's what we were going to do. We had some other strategy, I don't remember what it was, but I didn't think it was very good. And I tried to debate either in the exact opposite way that our opponents did, or in a very similar way. and sort of debates on their own ground. And those things to me were the most enlightening, I suppose. I learned the most from it and I enjoyed it the most. So, and that style of debate always appealed to me as well. I liked the persuasive elements of it that weren't sort of technical, dry, and boring. And I think that a lot of debate is. And back then it was even more technical probably than it is now.
Yeah, I was wondering what you thought about that, like, because, you know, I think there would be at least some difference now in terms of the reaction that people would have to, like, Fort Hayes kind of arguments. I mean, it was kind of a year and a half before that when they went off the flow and kind of did all that stuff, but... you seem pretty comfortable. That didn't seem, even in the debate, it didn't seem like it was referenced, like that wasn't the norm. Did you feel like you were unique in that sense, uniquely comfortable? Was that like kind of an opportunity for you to try some new stuff out?
Well, I think that we were probably more flexible in style than most teams were, and I didn't really feel like I had an investment in one style over another. I enjoyed their style of debate. I also enjoyed very technical, very fast, evidence-intensive debate. So, to me, it felt strange to me that people reacted negatively to what Fort Hayes was doing and that they wanted to sort of force them back into the mainstream of debate that seemed both boring and counterproductive to me. So I enjoyed that style. We'd debated them before, so it wasn't the sort of style part of the debate was not totally alien to us, although the particular arguments that they made were different than the ones that we had heard before. I think that maybe my greatest strength, I guess, as a debater was this sort of ideological flexibility. And I think that's something that used to be fairly common and is no longer very common at all.
Yeah, I agree with you. It seems like there's, with the pref sheet and the way that kind of a more diversified judge pool is out there, it seems like there's an advantage to sort of specializing now rather than kind of being able to do everything. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think you're right, and I also think that kind of argument is not new anymore. So people who initially had a negative reaction to it and didn't really know why have had time to convince themselves ex post facto that they had some good reason to be afraid or uncomfortable with that kind of debate. And other people have just sort of hardened ideologically now that they've had exposure to it. I don't think I was uniquely flexible at all. I think that it used to be much more common, and over time, the community has kind of polarized between extremes that it sort of self-defines as left and right, even though that's, you know, not even a meaningful distinction.
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely think that it's become much more fragmented than it was, and to everyone's detriment. Judging is much more polarized than it used to be. Debating is even more extreme, I think, and clashing not over sort of fundamental ideas, but the legitimacy of those ideas in the first place, and that bothers me.
Yeah, how often do you end up in that situation? I mean, you're one of the most widely prepped people, so I imagine you end up in a lot of debates where there's supposed vast disagreement over core fundamental issues, but really it's just kind of two people yelling at each other from walls.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. And for a couple of years, that's basically the only kind of debate that I judged. I would occasionally judge two sort of extreme critical teams debating each other or two extreme policy teams debating each other, but not often. Most of the debates I judged were two teams with widely divergent ideas about debate, and they unfortunately were almost always resolved in sort of, is this style fair, is this acceptable, the kind of framework angle, which I think is by far the least interesting kind of debate to watch.
Well, here's the thing about you as a judge, though, is like, when you end up judging, what does the outcome end up being, though, in that debate? I mean, do you think that it's kind of a 50-50 split, or do you think that one side might be ahead of the other? I mean, you judge a lot of these debates. Regardless of your personal proclivity, is somebody ahead right now? I mean, it seems like the K teams, no offense, but they just don't seem to do as well at the NDT or consistently. I don't really judge those clash debates enough. Is there something happening there?
I don't really know what's going on, because you're right that they don't seem to be doing as well as they used to, but when I actually judge sort of K versus hardcore policy debates, I almost always vote for the K teams, not because I think they're right, but because I think that policy teams are still bad at engaging them. They still want to say, you can't do this, instead of what you said is incorrect. And I think that they get away with it more now, maybe just because the community overall has shifted in that direction. But I wish people would impact her and stuff all the time.
Oh, yeah. Well, me too. I mean, it's just, I mean, why not take the ground you have, you know? But I think, you know, a lot of people are like, and maybe this is one of the things that distinguished you too, is like a lot of people feel like they really need to be prepped. You know, we're in an era where coaching seems to be really important, especially at the higher levels. And, you know, do you think that what importance did coaching play in your career as a debater? What importance do you think it should play now as a coach? And what do you think about that general sense of the importance of coaching in the current community?
It was very important to me when I was in high school, especially. I was very lucky to have excellent coaches. My novice coach, I think, is still maybe the best novice coach I've ever known, Scott Warrow, who's now a high school teacher at Groves High School, was my coach my first year in debate at East Lansing High School. And Ray Sigmund, the brother of Joe Sigmund, who I debated with my senior year in both high school and college, was our coach my varsity coach when I was in high school. And Ray taught me a lot about debate, and so did Scotty. In college, it was more difficult because I didn't always have a perfectly harmonious relationship with our coaching staff. So some people were willing to sort of put up with my innate hostility, I guess. I don't know what else to call it. Like John Sullivan, for example, who was one of the assistants at Michigan State when I first got there, was very, very helpful and taught me a lot about how to think about debate. And in fact, he, among the many people I know who used to have this trait, John sort of embodied the idea that you should be able to do anything, and that you should be able to exercise flexibility and diversity in arguments that you made. So I think that trait is to a large degree, I learned from him. Later on, I had difficulty sort of cooperating with our coaching staff, but I think that coaches can make debaters more successful. I think, though, that it's a kind of a dirty secret that people think that coaches are really decisive. I think that sometimes they can be, but often they aren't, that we sometimes trick ourselves into thinking that we have more influence on outcomes than we really do. We certainly manipulate them at the margins, the chances of winning and losing, but I think that the best things that we can do are sort of impart ideas about debate and ways of looking at debate and its role in the world, rather than sort of teach people the technicalities of it. Those things they tend to learn for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stories of people who had no coaching who were successful, and a lot who had a ton of coaching and were not successful. It seems like, clearly the primary factor in a debater's success is their own relationship to the game. As a coach, what do you try to do to foster that? I mean, because it seems like what you had as a debater is probably pretty hard to teach, probably pretty hard to train. What have you learned throughout the course of your coaching career, maybe even through things like debate camp or whatever, to help others sort of develop the relationship that they need to have to debate to be successful?
Well, teaching people argument flexibility is almost a paradox. You can't really be inflexible about the idea that they should be flexible. And one of the lessons that took me a long time to learn is that I'm best at just helping people do what they want to do. And whether it's what I want them to do or not isn't really all that important. I sort of can't force people. Maybe some people can. Maybe I'm just bad at it. I can't really convince people to see the world the way I do. But I try to help them accomplish their goals in debate, whatever they are, and to do it through whatever style of argument they choose. I don't really think it's my place. I don't really feel comfortable saying I know how debate should be, this is how you should do it. But I do think I can help people sort of realize their own visions of what it should be like. And I prefer that. I dislike the model of coaching as a set of instructions that include sort of broad, big-picture purpose of debate. All of that, I think, is a worthy discussion, but it's not something that it's my place to impart. So I try to assist people in executing what they want to do rather than tell them what I want them to do.
Do you think that aspect of, like, pure facilitation changes when you're leading a lab? And what I mean by that is, you know, the kids, they kind of show up, they pay the money so that they can be taught by an expert, you know. They almost pay the money to be told what they're right and wrong about, and you have a much more limited set of time. So I'm wondering if that changes your approach somewhat when you're leading a lab situation.
Well, for one thing, I love debate camp. That's my favorite time of the year. I would do it all
year. Me too.
Year, probably,
I love it. Oh, my God. It's awesome.
It's great. And one thing that I really like about it is working with people who have approaches that are different than mine. I actually, when I'm here, don't feel here at debate camp, I don't feel like the requirements are exactly the same or the expectations are the same. Like you said, it does change a little bit. And I feel more comfortable saying, this is what I want debate to be like. This is how you do that. Because there are other people who offer alternative perspectives, and the students sort of get to choose or absorb it from all of us.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's good, probably, for me to present my ideas, which, and sometimes it's a caricature. Sometimes,
I mean, that's what they're paying for, right? I mean, it's kind of
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what they're paying for, and they're exposed to a whole lot of people. So if we represent different ideas, I think that's helpful for them.
Yeah. Definitely my favorite thing about camp is two things, like the temporary team aspect, where it's like, it's kind of like hyper team relationships, where it's like, they're almost sweeter because they get to end very quickly and nothing like really raw and terrible is exposed. And then also being able to consistently work with really smart people in the community who have really good ideas and sort of collaborate. Do you find that some of your best concepts and approaches towards coaching your team in the regular season in both high school and college come from kind of the laboratory environment of the camp?
Yeah, I think that's definitely correct. And it's also a chance to work with other people. Sometimes I have a general idea of what the other lab leaders think about something before camp starts, but being exposed to other debate coaches all day, every day for weeks sort of sharpens your understanding of what the various perspectives are that are out there. And I think that I learn a lot from it, either because, you know, I pick up something that I like and think that it's correct and change what I believe, or because I'm exposed to the opposite so starkly that, you know, I examine the fundamentals of what I believe and feel more strongly about them because I think someone's wrong. But generally, that doesn't happen. Generally, it's sort of a dialogue and a chance to understand the way that people think about debate. No one really coaches you how to coach or teaches you how to do the various things that we're called on to do. And when I was debating, I had this idea that our coaches were, you know, had much broader exposure to ideas, and somehow I decided that they had some training that now I understand you have to do for yourself. So the students, I think, debate camp is excellent for them, but it's at least as helpful for us as it is for them.
Yeah, I find that I learn just as much as anyone I'm teaching. One thing I wanted to ask you about was, and you know, you're not really going to have a successful interview with Callum unless you try to inspire a little bit of hate.
Not hard.
Yeah. Well, so you proposed a Russia topic, last year. And, there was actually a lot of community support for it. And it seemed like kind of in the final hour, it was overtaken by the topic we've had. One second.
this is 2 years ago. The agriculture.
2 years ago. That's what I mean. Yeah, 2 years ago, we had agriculture, and
right.
What I wanted to ask was, you didn't resubmit the paper last year, and is that
right.
Because you are wounded by that outcome from 2 years ago? Is that because you do not believe this community is ready, sort of in a Nietzschean way, or you know what? Are we ever going to see the Russia topic paper again, or what?
Well, if I stay around to debate much longer, yeah, the Russia paper will come back. I'm never going to give up on this idea. I still think that it's important. I mean, and for my own selfish reasons, I want debate to be about stuff that I know a lot about already. Because it's not like I know so much that I'm not going to learn anything, you know? And yeah, I've been fascinated with Russia as long as I can remember. So it'll definitely make a reappearance, I think. The reason I didn't resubmit it last year, actually, is that I liked the nuclear weapons topic a lot.
Oh, okay.
I was afraid that I'd split the ballot if I introduced Russia. So I liked the nuclear. I had written but didn't even submit a paper about reducing U.S. military deployments abroad, and I didn't submit that, and I didn't resubmit Russia because I thought that the nuclear weapons topic was good and that it already had a lot of momentum, and I didn't want to mess that up.
So what do you think about how the nuclear weapons topic went?
You know, it was really frustrating to me in the end, actually. I liked it, but you know, I spent a lot of time, and I did even before the topic was announced or people had even talked about it, reading about nuclear strategy. It's just one of my interests, and I thought that the big appeal that it had to me was that people would be forced to learn the details, to have a really in-depth knowledge of nuclear war and nuclear war plans, things that recur on every topic, and I thought it'd be great that people sort of really get to see the nuts and bolts of it. I don't think that happened, actually. I think that some of the, like, the scripts that exist in debate, the assumptions that people have that they don't really question, things like, you know, a nuclear war would be extinction, we're sort of locked in this idea of, like, 1980s style.
Yeah, I was shocked that that never got questioned last year. Like,
that's what made me the most unhappy about the topic.
We didn't even come up with a differential understanding of nuclear wars. Like,
no, we didn't, and we didn't even bother. We relied on the worst scholarship, we relied on poorly developed arguments, and that was okay with most people. In fact, I remember talking to someone not too long before that topic was selected, and we were having a conversation. I had coached someone that this person knows, and they said to me, yeah, well, I know that this guy got one thing wrong, because he said that you claimed that a nuclear war might not cause human extinction. I said, you know, of course, every nuclear war would not cause human extinction. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But the idea that a script like that persists annoys me, and we didn't challenge those assumptions. The topic sort of got drawn into the same stuff that it always does.
It seems to me sometimes that we see the topic as an opportunity to, and this goes for every kind of debater and debate coach, that we see the topic as an opportunity to kind of replay what we feel like works rather than investigate new stuff. And yeah, I'm with you on the same problem that we had. It's not, I think the topic was pretty good, but I think we could have explored it a lot more.
I agree. And really, I should give up on this idea that topics about that are in-depth discussions of something we debate all the time is really going to change anything. Like, I don't think that this year's high school topic is going to give people a more nuanced understanding of the differences between strategy and grand strategy or air versus land power and all that. I'd like it if it did, but it won't. Yeah. And the nuclear weapons topic didn't do that for nuclear war either.
How different do you think, because you're talking about the way that the high school debaters are going to interpret their topic, and it's also a military topic. You're coming right off the college season where we were discussing those issues. We're working with kids now discussing similar issues in a way, hegemony and military strategy and all that kind of stuff. What do you think the level of sophistication is at high school compared to college when you're looking at, you know, maybe the best high school kids and the run-of-the-mill college debater? I don't know. I don't really know the answer to that.
I don't really know either. A lot of it depends more on individuals. It's tough to make sort of broad comparisons, because the quality of high school and college debate is relatively different year to year based on the people who are at the top of it, I guess. But I think that the best high school debaters have, you know, really good, really nuanced understandings of their topics sometimes. And I think that a lot of college debaters don't, because the topics are narrower and research is never really as broad and exploratory, I guess, as it is in high school. I think that there's some ways that college debate does not really get to the heart of topics the way that high school debate does. That said, the best college debaters do a great deal of research and sometimes know a lot about the topic, at least as it translates into strategic debate arguments. Not always so much a lot about the topic in a broader sense.
I'm getting the sense from you that you that we have entered a bad stage of debating in college. Do you think that we... what do you think, is college debate or is debate getting better all the time, or do you think that we go in up and down stretches?
Well, we definitely go in up and down stretches, I think, but I don't think it's getting net better over time. I think that it's different now than it used to be. I think that when I debated, I thought that the top debaters of that time were probably better than the top debaters of now, with some exceptions. I think that there are, you know, some individuals who are as good or better than...
Okay, well, just put it on the board. Who would be a debater from your time that would just straight be better than the good debaters now? Are you willing to say that?
Like Michael Gottlieb. You know, no one compares to that guy. I think that the top back then was very good, but the middle was not.
Oh, really? Okay.
I think that the middle part of debate has gotten better every year. But unfortunately, I think it's starting... The whole thing is pulling together. And there's sort of a big collection around the center. Debaters now seem to me, anyway, to be more standardized, that there are fewer exceptional individuals who sort of have their own style and there are more people who are very good at executing styles that are sort of either associated with their schools or associated with broader schools of thought. But I think that there's less sort of wild talent, and there's less unique style and input, and there's more technical sophistication in implementing something that someone has done already.
Hmm. Do you think that's just like pragmatics or what? I mean, why is that happening?
I think that there's more of a national debate culture now than there used to. I think that there's more consensus in a lot of ways. Even though the community's become more split between critique and policy and stuff like that, those splits are themselves formulaic. It's just part of the culture. And I think that people sort of pull towards standardization. I don't know if it is just because it provides a competitive edge or whether the greater ability to share evidence and instruction at debate camps or on the internet just sort of naturally causes people to clump together. But I definitely think it's happening.
All right, so I attended the TOC this year, and mm-hmm. I was kind of shocked by the coaching staffs, the coaching staff ratio to debater, and also the number of huge college programs that seem to be enemies during the college debate season that team up to support some big high school programs. Now, I'm not trying to be disparaging or anything, but man, that tournament seems intense. And what is your view of the TOC?
Well, it certainly is intense. When I debated, I didn't like the TOC at all, actually. In the first few times that I coached there, it was a little miserable for me. It was like the NDT, but I felt farther removed from it. I think that you're right that coaching staffs have expanded a lot. In some ways, I guess that's good. Like when I debated, the first time I went to the TOC, there were a couple of schools that had enormous hired gun college coaching staffs. It gave them an enormous advantage over people who didn't. And I think it's easier now for smaller schools to hire people to help them. That said, it also sort of forces them into maybe artificial commonality with the college topic or the ideas of college debaters. And that's a little disappointing, I guess. But, I mean,
it was a good debate, I got to say. The TOC was some high-quality debate. I mean,
beyond a doubt, it's, you know, the quality of debate there is good, and that's heartening to me. I like that. It's not that, you know, people have access to a lot more than they used to in some ways, or at least the top programs do, but I think now that those things are starting to trickle down, like the size of coaching staff, the availability of evidence and information sharing and all that stuff, overall, I think the quality of it is higher, and I think that that's good. That said, it is intense, and it's sometimes very stressful, but, you know, most of the students I've coached there really enjoyed their experiences, and in the end, it's not really about whether I want to be there or not, because their mommies and daddies pay their taxes, and their taxes end up in my wallet. So it's really about whether they think that's worthwhile, and I think that they probably do.
Okay, let me shift gears here a little bit. You now help Harvard, right?
Yeah.
How is it working for Dallas and Sherry? They seem great.
I love working for Harvard. I love Dallas and Sherry, and the culture of the team is really something good, I think. I didn't really want to be in debates much longer, and the only thing that's really causing me to reconsider that is how much I enjoy coaching for Harvard. I think it'll probably mean that I'm in debate a year or two longer than I would be otherwise, assuming that they rehire me, obviously.
Of course they're going to rehire you, but that is awesome. It makes me love them even more, but they seem sweet.
It's great. The whole outlook towards debate on that team, I think, is something that is really positive, and I enjoy it. It's competitive, and it's smart, and it's hardworking, but it's not hyper-competitive to the detriment of everything else that goes on in the lives of the students and the coaches, and that's really something that is great about Harvard.
And you've also spent a lot of time at Glenbrook South.
Yeah.
So, Abby, you must have enjoyed it there as well.
I do like Glenbrook South, yeah. I think Tara, who I work for, she's the best high school director I've ever interacted with. She's got a mix of traits that are very difficult to find all in a single individual, and that's good. I like GBS a lot. I really like high school debate in general. partly because the students are so enthusiastic about it and it's so new to them. You know, they haven't had time to get as jaded as I am, and that's refreshing.
That's cool. Okay, so now I'm going to try to inspire some hate again. So you lost the 2002 CETA National Championship on a 5-4. Does it hurt as bad as it did then?
No, not really. I haven't. Well, so for one thing, I was a junior, so I knew I was coming back. It wasn't the end of my debate career. If it was, I might have felt different about it, I guess. It is one of the only debates I remember where the debate ended and I thought we won and then we lost. I made the opposite mistake much more often, where the debate ended and I thought that we lost and we actually won. So at the time, I was surprised that we lost. Excuse me, but I don't think that that means that the decision was wrong, necessarily. And ultimately, you win or lose a debate because you succeed or fail in convincing judges to vote for you, and there's no such thing as objective victory as long as someone doesn't, you know, like, deliberately cheat and vote against you, and I don't think that that happens. So, we didn't win. It's the way it works.
Well,
if we can't convince people to vote for us, then we don't deserve to win.
Fair enough. To talk about the debate specifics a little bit, the 2NC is one of the best debate speeches of that era. It's got to be. I mean, it was amazing. And there's a moment, the 2AC by Jason Regnier was very strong and, put all the right arguments in the right efficiency and ratio, and was kind of like, even though there were no flows, like pretty technically strong. And so you had a lot to kind of overcome at that point of the debate. The 1NC, like you said, half of it was a little flat. And so the 2NC kind of had a lot on it. And you really jumped on that speech and sort of turned the debate. In the last portion of the speech with, you're trying to fit some stuff in. There's like a minute left. You're fitting a bunch of things in pretty well. And then with 15 seconds left, you look up from your page and you say this line.
How do you want to end this topic? How do you want to end it? Resolve the last debate of the year? Do you want to say that federal control will be redeployed, that it has a chance of redemption, or do you want to condemn it for what it is, a system of violent destruction which has no hope for indigenous peoples, none that they can name, and none that I can think of?
At that point in the debate, you really shift the ethos of the debate to your side. And the cross-ex that happens next has the kind of famous moment where you're like, if I have to read a card on genocide bad, then I quit. You're really kind of owning the room at that point. What do you think, and I think if you straw-polled the judges at that point, it would have been like a 7-2 or an 8-1. I mean, you were just really running that debate at that time. What do you think happened in the second half of that debate? Not to say that you definitively lost or something, but I think you lost control of that moment of ethos you had in the middle of the debate. What do you think happened?
Well, the 2NR definitely wasn't as good as the 2NC. So, is entirely my fault. It doesn't really have to do with the content of our arguments so much as my failure to execute them as well later as I did in the middle part of the debate. I think that's really a big part of it. It's also that we were sort of inexperienced in having debates like that. Although we debated Fort Hayes, the sort of details of this debate were difficult to pin down, and we had never debated them in front of a panel like the one we were debating in front of then. There were more than one person on the panel who had never judged us before, and we didn't have a very good read on. So I think that we tried later, or I tried later, to shift between persuasion, where I thought that maybe we had overplayed our hand, back towards technical competence that I thought would appeal to, which I thought incorrectly would appeal to some of the people that ultimately voted against us.
Yeah, I think maybe if that 2NR was like the same tenor of the 2NC in terms of its rhetorical style, might have got it done. Last thing I want to ask you about pertains to your academic scholarship, actually. I wanted to ask you a question about history. Isaac wanted me to ask you, what is history? But I think it might be better if I did it in a more applied way. Marxists in debate oftentimes defend their kind of method of analyzing social relations, saying everything is caused by cap. They say that's historical materialism. that is a theory that Isaiah Berlin describes as being capable of application to every aspect of the social situation. This came to be known as Marxist historical materialism. I'm wondering if you think that this is just one example of how history kind of gets referenced in debate. You know, we have a theory that explains biopower from the very beginning. We have a theory of capital that can explain all oppression by one unifying ideology. What do you think of the way, first, that history is used in debate? How could it be used better? And then just in general, what is history to you? What is the practice of good history?
Well, I think that, for one thing, people know stunningly little about history. And maybe this is just me being old and starting to ossify into my discipline and all that. But people, it's shocking to me how little people know and how thin historical analysis is when it's really important. Like, maybe the best example is when someone says economic collapse causes war. It's what happened to cause the Second World War. Making a claim like that, this thing caused the Second World War, this one factor is so... so bizarre, almost. It seems like outlandishly dumb to me. But people do it all the time. To say any one thing explains all of history, to me, is a kind of almost mind-boggling arrogance. No one thing explains all of history everywhere. No one thing explains every element of human change in the human condition over thousands of years.
I'm wondering if you might agree with this quote from Marx, who is really a historian in a lot of ways. He wrote, when one studies these forms of evolution separately, talking about the difference between Romans and Europeans, and then compares them, one can easily find the clue to this phenomenon, but one will never get there by using one's master key in general historical philosophical theory, which explains everything because it explains nothing, the supreme virtue of which consists in being super historical.
Yeah, I mean, any theory that explains everything does explain nothing. That part I agree with. The idea of historical causation is so complicated that I think that a lot of arguments that rely on it are necessarily weak. And the more you know about, or the more one knows about any particular event, the more difficult it is to say that you've identified its causes, I think. Especially an event like on the scale of the First World War, the Second World War, something that involves individual decisions of millions of people that add up into one collective action or, you know, a series of them that has a particular result. I spent the last couple of weeks reading about the idea of causation in history and what it means. And I think that as time advances, we should be less and less confident that we can explain history in a sort of overall way. Maybe we can explain how particular events occur, but I don't even think we can really explain how classes of events occur, like how wars break out or how revolutions happen. It involves much, much more specificity than that, and the grander the theory and the broader its aim, the less likely I think it is to be useful as an explanatory tool, because the more cases it will be forced to overlook.
Cool. This has been a great first edition of Critical Issues and Debate. We've been fortunate to have Callum Matheson with us, and I just wanted to extend my sincere thanks for you being with us here in our first ever podcast.
Well, thank you, Scott. I'm really glad that you gave me the chance to do it.